Hey guys, you're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We interview the very best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and even entrepreneurial worlds. And with their help, we give you some of the best advice on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review. On today's episode, episode number 105, entitled How to Be a Man, I chat with Frank Miniter, the author of New York Times best-selling book, The Ultimate Man's Survival Guide. The Ultimate Man's Survival Guide is one of the coolest books I've ever read. It's all about how to survive in the wilderness, how to hunt, how to fish, how to take care of yourself, how to defend yourself. Literally one of the coolest books I've ever read. Read it probably 6, 7, I don't even know, years ago when it first came out. Picked it up in my local library and had to renew it multiple times because it was so good. I didn't want to give it back. So it was a pleasure to bring Frank on, follow up with him on the book and talk about some social issues as well. What it means to be a man in 2017, how to be a man in 2017. We talk about feminism and some other really interesting and fascinating topics. Frank is probably one of the manliest men I've ever met, and I know you guys are going to absolutely enjoy and love this episode. The time is almost here for you to get your 2017 Elite Man Conference tickets. Tickets for the best men's conference in the world go on sale Monday, February 13th. You do not want to miss this. Last year we had over 30 speakers and hundreds of guys at our event, and this year is going to be even better. We have some of our best speakers from last year coming back, and new ones as well who will rock the stage. Experts like Scott McKay, Connor Beaton, Kim Seltzer, David D. Las Marinas, Joel Bogus, Nicholas Bailey, Claudia Klox, and so many more will be giving you their best advice on how to become the best version of yourself. And they'll be tackling topics like dating advice, confidence, health, fitness, business, overcoming your fears, and finding your purpose as a man. This conference is the one event you have to be at in 2017. If you're truly looking to take hold of your life and transform the really big areas of your life, this is your chance. Go to elitemanconference.com and click on the 2017 link to get your tickets for this year. Or just type in elitemanconference.com/2017. Either way works. Again, tickets go on sale Monday, February 13th. This will be the super early bird pricing for them, meaning you do have to act fast to get them at this rate. They'll be going up by 33% just 2 weeks after on February 28th. So if you're serious about attending the best men's conference in the world, get them early and get them fast. Elitemanconference.com. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from ElitemanMagazine.com, and my guest today is executive editor of American Hunter magazine and New York Times best-selling author Frank Miniter. Frank, thanks so much for coming on the show, man.
Hey, thanks for having me here, Justin.
Hey, Frank, I've been a big fan of your work, man. I mentioned a couple minutes ago, offline, how I stumbled upon your book, The Ultimate Man's Survival Guide, probably now, I don't know, when it first came out, I think it came out in like 2009 or so, this was like 7, 8 years ago, stumbled upon it in the library of all things, just kind of searching around different cool books, picked it up, fell in love with it, kept talking to my girlfriend about all the cool things in the book, you know, all the cool survival techniques, the hunting, the fishing, all that stuff, loved the book. Put it back in the library, you know, gave it back a month later or so. And, this is even before the podcast is around. Totally forgot about the book. Fast forward 5, 6 years later, I'm talking to my friend Scott McKay, who's, you know, been on the podcast a couple times now. Great friend of mine. Brings up your name, Frank Miniter. And I'm thinking, where do I know that name from? Frank Miniter. I'm rattling the back of my mind trying to figure out where I knew the name. And then it dawns on me. You're the guy who wrote one of the coolest books I ever read.
The libraries are okay with me. I was wondering if I was banned from them or what, just being too politically incorrect. That's good.
But yeah, man, I knew immediately. Scott had to give me the intro, so I'm so thankful he did. Great to have you on, brother. I'm really excited for this interview. You know, I wanted to pick your brain on a lot of different things. And I know you do a lot of sort of manly work, like what it means to be a man. Along with, you know, doing some of the survival stuff, which I love in general anyway. So, again, man, I'm happy to have you on, and I can't wait to pick your brain.
Go ahead, man.
So actually, let's start first thing first. Let's start with, how did you become the editor of American Hunter magazine? Because that's a pretty big magazine, right?
Oh yeah, that's a million circ magazine. I actually, after college, I drove west, like a lot of guys have that adventure in them. I ended up in Wyoming working for a small daily newspaper for a year, which was just a year filled with adventures where I got on the back of a rodeo bull like a complete idiot. It was lasted about 0.1 seconds. I got to do all sorts of things. I got to go round up stray cattle with cowboys. I did everything you could possibly do as an adventure. And from that, I springboarded into Outdoor Life magazine, where I was for 7 or 8 years, until I decided to move on to American Hunter magazine, which I'm still on there as a field editor. I write a column for them, too. So it was always that chase of adventure and that understanding of who you were and what I wanted to do. And these magazine jobs, I mean, they've taken me all over the world. I've been fishing and hunting and just hiking and backpacking from Japan to Russia to Africa down to the Amazon. It's just been wonderful to be able to write about that, live those adventures, live that kind of lifestyle while asking those big questions and what makes us into all we can be.
Cool, man. So have you always been into hunting, fishing, doing that kind of stuff like your entire life?
Yeah, I grew up on this little mountain in upstate New York with thousands of acres out the back door. And I think I was gone as much as possible, me and my brothers. And I made my own bow when I was 10 and started hunting with it. I did all that kind of stuff. And I got into wilderness survival and started getting those books out like a little kid will do and just learned all those skills and all that lifestyle. And that just led me into, the hunting and fishing lifestyle, which took me to Outdoor Life magazine and then American Hunter. But now I write a column for Forbes, too, and I'm kind of all over the place, which makes it interesting. Keep asking these questions and keep finding interesting people and really pushing. And that's what led me to my last book. I mean, This Will Make a Man of You came out last November. And what led me to that was actually a guy from the Ultimate Man Survival Guide, you remember, right in the intro there was Juan Macho, one of the premier American runners of the Bulls. And being a journalist, when I went to Pamplona to run with the Bulls, just driven to do that, I had to go find the consummate guy, right? The guy who could teach me how do you really do this? And I found this incredible Cuban American named Juan Macho, is his real name. And he showed me how to run with the Bulls and survive. And he showed me the depths to the fiesta, to what's really there, why it's there, and how people challenge themselves in those streets to grow into, by facing their fears, to grow into who they really want to be. I mean, this is what guys will do no matter what. I mean, you could take these rites of passage away from a guy and he's going to still find a cliff to jump off somewhere. I mean, we're going to go through these things anyway. This is a real ritualized kind of adventure going through this with him. So I ran the Bulls there, and just getting to know him, I decided I had to go back and really understand what that whole fiesta is all about. So I ended up with this crazy group of people who chase Hemingway from Paris to Pamplona every year, going into the depths of that fiesta. And I had some really close calls with Bulls. I even did the suicide run, running right at the Bulls in the beginning of the course. Wow. And then you dodge them as they go past you. I've been in the arena with the vaquillas, which are these trained cows are trained to throw people. It's a whole other Spanish rite of passage. All the steps and levels of it, with Juan showing me the philosophy behind it, was what led to my book, This Will Make a Man of You. So I'm still wondering about these things and testing these things, as I think we all should.
Yeah. And Frank, just for kind of a reference, how old are you now? Like still running 40, in these?
Yeah.
40 what?
44.
44. Wow, man. Good for you. That's pretty impressive.
No, I'm still going to go back to Pamplona again this summer. I can't wait.
That's cool, man. I'm actually, we're doing a video chat. We don't usually do these on the Elite Man, but I can, actually see you, and you look like you're in phenomenal shape too. So that's good.
And I grew up boxing too. I still hit the bag.
Nice.
I was lucky. Actually, Floyd Patterson had a gym in my hometown, the former heavyweight champ.
Was it Catskill, New York?
No, that's where actually Tyson trained in Catskill.
I was going to say, sounds.
In New Falls, New York.
New Falls, New York. Okay.
And he would let any kid in to come and train. He wouldn't even ask for money. He just wanted to show kids how to be those stand-up kind of guys. I mean, the first day he'd have you into the gym, what he would do is he'd put you in the ring with a professional boxer. And he would have that professional boxer kind of give you a little beatdown. Not really hurt you, but just to see if you could take it, because he didn't want to bother training you if you couldn't take a punch. If you didn't come back the second day after getting beat up that first day, then he thought, well, you weren't worth it anyway. So that's what I did. I got into the ring. I knew that was going to happen, and I got knocked down a couple of times by a professional fighter named Mike Peoples. And I came back the next day and stayed there for years, fighting in his gym and learning how to box. So going through those steps, I mean, that was a real rite of passage in itself. Mm-hmm. You know, he's always the stand-up gentleman and the iconic guy you wanted to be. So these kind of role models are also part of what shape us and bring us up.
Yeah, man, I agree. So Yeah, was that Floyd Patterson's gym or Customato's gym?
Floyd Patterson's gym. Customato was his trainer.
Yeah.
But so, Floyd, after he retired, I mean, this is the 1980s.
Okay.
Yeah. So he was retired. He had his own gym. His son, Tracy Harris Patterson, was then the world champ when I was in his gym. So he was training a lot of fighters. There were a lot of pros coming in and out of that gym. But no, Floyd was very well retired at that point in time.
Yeah. Yeah, no, because I know Customato was Floyd and Tyson's, and they must have been right in the same area, Catskill kind of area.
It's an hour apart.
Yeah, yeah. That's pretty cool, man. Yeah, I did some boxing too as well. Back when I was 16 years old, 17. There was a couple of pro fighters in there too, and I actually used to spar with a few of them. I'm about 165 now. Back then, weight class, I was probably like 140 or so. So these guys are like welterweights, I think it's called in boxing now. I mean, I kind of get the UFC welterweight and thing messed up now, but 140 or so pound guys I used to spar with, and there was a couple of them. And, you know, not to brag or anything, because trust me, I could never have continued boxing. And actually, I kind of quit because I was getting headaches and stuff, so I didn't want to kind of, you know, continue to do it. But that's one of the things you just mentioned was one of the fighters said. He's like, you know, I come in here, you know, new guys come in here all the time. I spar with you. I know you could be like a real fighter. I know you like want to do this because when I hit you, you keep coming forward. Like you don't just like shy away and cover up. The first day you came in, kind of the same thing. You kind of roughed me up a little bit. Didn't completely kick my ass because he took it easy on me. But that's kind of what he said too, is like, you know, a lot of people come and go. It's like, if you come in here and you can't last the first day, you know, this isn't for you. And I did it for a couple of years. And it was really cool. It was just really, it gave me a lot of confidence inside about like not only defending myself, but just knowing that I could do that and kind of take that, you know, I guess willpower, struggle or like whatever fear, like getting over your fear of getting hit in the face and, you know, keep doing it. So there's something to be said about, you know, getting in there and kind of putting on some gloves and fighting someone else across from you.
That's beautiful. And every rite of passage, because that's the question I had for myself with this current book, This Will Make a Man of You. I said, philosophically, this society right now is asking this question, what makes men? Because we seem to be destroying the thing that what makes men. So what is that? How do you answer that question? And it seemed like a pretty impossible question to answer. So I decided, well, as a journalist, let me go to the places you all agree still make men. Let me talk to fire departments. Let me talk to New York Fire Department. Let me talk to U.S. Marines, Navy SEALs, Green Berets, you know, all these kind of places, these cultures, these subcultures that still we agree create people of character. And as I began to talk to them, I realized that actually the rules are the same that you go through. When we're talking about going to the gym the first time and dealing with that, there's always that terror and confusion at the beginning of any rite of passage. There's always something designed to tear you down so you can be built up onto a greater ideal as you chase whatever that ideal is, the ideal Marine, the ideal priest in the dojo, the ideal karate master, depending on what belts you want, and so on. I mean, you're chasing an ideal, going through those struggles in that rite of passage. All of them actually have those same rules. Even running with the bulls does. There's that crazy terror and confusion right at the beginning. In fact, the first time I ran, I mean, you're falling apart inside. You got to be in the street at 7:30 in the morning, and they close the barriers, and the bulls don't come until 8. Mm-hmm. So you have 30 minutes waiting for those bulls to come, and you're not allowed to leave the street. Once you're in, they close those barriers, you're done. You're in the street. And there's this guy next to me. Now, Juan Macho, as I told you, taught me how to run. So I knew what I had to do and not do in order to survive. But this guy next to me is actually from Chicago, an American. And he didn't know what to do. And at first he was all boastful. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. You wouldn't believe it. And I'm going to grab that bull. But by the time he got close to 8 o'clock and the bulls are going to be coming, he was melting down. He was losing it the way a lot of the crowd was. And he finally decided, I can't take this. I can't survive. I have to get out of here. So he tries to crawl under the fence to get away. And a cop, big Spanish cop standing there, kicks him back into the street and screams at him. It's something I'll never forget. The Spanish cop screams in English, you wanted to be a man and run with the bulls? Now you must be a man and run with the bulls. Well, that guy was an enforcer for this real rite of passage. So I thought, that's crazy. Wow, that just happened. And this guy was completely out of his mind, though. He went under the fence again anyway. And this time the cop didn't even mess around. He just boom, 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 beat him with a baton, threw him down, said, just stay there. The guy was under arrest at that point. He's going to a Spanish jail. So the bulls came. I ran, go through this whole thing. Later I asked Juan Macho about that. I said, this is crazy. The cop beat him up, wouldn't let him out of the street. How is that? And he says, well, if he wasn't there enforcing that, you know what will happen? People panic, and they'll try to climb out when the bulls are coming. That'll cause a log jam in the middle of the street. You get a log jam with Spanish bulls coming in with those horns facing forward. What's going to happen is a lot of these bulls are really going to gore people. You're going to have people hurt like crazy. You're going to have people killed because people are panicking, losing it. But that cop there enforcing those rules and making us follow that, like a drill sergeant would in boot camp and so on, making you follow those rules, that kept us all a lot safer. It made us all man up. I mean, that's what it's about. It's like you're talking about with the boxing gym. That trainer in there telling you what it is. Can you stand up to this? Can you grow into this ideal?
Mm-hmm. No, it makes a lot of sense, man. And you're right. I think it's twofold. Like he's keeping everybody safe, the cop, the big cop there, Spanish guy. For sure, he's keeping everyone safe because it's going to create a logjam. People are going to get stampeded. The other guys who actually want to run the thing aren't going to be able to move around. But I think also he kind of has it too. Like, you know, you chose to do this, now do it. Like you wanted to have the balls to stand up and say you were going to run the bulls. You know, this is, you do what you said you were going to do. And I think it's great they pulled him out of there and threw him in jail.
Festival here. And the things they do, you just, there's no possible way you could do it here. There'd be lawyers involved and it just wouldn't work.
Yeah. That's great, man. But, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. Like if you're going to do something like that, if you're going to put yourself out there, it's usually too, it's always like the loud kind of obnoxious guys who are like overly confident, you know, that saying they're going to do this or saying they're going to do that, then end up not being the people that follow through on what they say.
In a fight, those are the people I'm not worried about. Exactly. Being loud and boastful, that's an insecurity issue right there. There's something. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to worry about those people. It's that little quiet guy you better watch out for.
How many people get run over in these typically, like yearly, like when the running of the bulls out? Is it every year, by the way?
Yeah, every July.
Yeah. How many people get hurt in these things?
Yeah, there's 8 runs in a row each morning, right? Injuries, like pretty, you know, hospitalized injuries. And every couple of years, someone dies in the street. Other people that will die, but they just die after us. They don't count them because they died in the hospital later. So, but you're looking at, 2,000 people in the street and 10 get hurt. So your odds are pretty good, unless you do something stupid or you just get very unlucky. Your odds are pretty good you're going to be just fine.
Mm-hmm. What was, like, the technique that you used to be safe?
Well, the key is to get into a good part of the street. And I like Estafeta, which is this long straight run. There's nowhere to get out of Estafeta, but it's a long straight run. And those bulls, you pretty much know where they're going to be. In a certain part, you're typically going to be in the center of the street, and hopefully they're going to be in a group. So when the people really start running, you just start running, and you'll feel it when the bulls are close, even though there's people all over you. I've had people jump on my back. In the last run I did, wow. A girl, literally an American girl, jumped on my back screaming, "We're going to die." And that stopped me. And you get stopped in the street, and then a bull's going to go right through you. So I had to just knock her off. I mean, I used my elbow and just knocked her off me. No choice. You know, she shouldn't have been there if she didn't know what she was doing. It sounds hard, but it's just true. So you get running, and then the bulls will get really close to you. And what you'll do is, if you're uncomfortable, you don't know where the bulls are behind you, you got to be moving. You don't try to stop. You got to be moving, and then just dodge right or left, depending on what your situation is. And you'll get to the side of the street, and for the most part, the bulls will go right past you, and you'll be fine. But if you get into the bulls, which I've done a few times, where you're actually going their same pace, especially towards the end of Estafeta before you go into the arena, then you can be right with the bulls. That's those beautiful moments where you'll see that in slow motion sometimes in these replays, when the bulls are running along and someone gently puts their hand on the back of the bull and they're kind of one together. You know, they're all part of the stampede together, as they like to put it there. That's beautiful. Then you feel it within yourself. You've just become this wild animal. You're wild for a minute with them until you break away. You know, so that's what you do. But if you get knocked down in the street, this is the key rule. If you get knocked down, don't get up in front of the bulls. You get up. An American was killed right where I like to run, because literally he got knocked down, stood up, and the bull just didn't even flinch. Just went right through him. The horn went right through his heart. Wow. He just went down. He was just dead almost instantly. You know, pretty well-known American killed, just because he didn't know what to do. He shouldn't have stood up. If he just stayed there, the bull will try not to step on you. It still might, but it'll try not to step on you. More than likely, you're going
to
be fine.
Interesting. Yeah, I was thinking, that's kind of, I think, first initial instinct is to stand back up, you know, try to get to your feet and run off to the side. But it's interesting, the bull tries to actually avoid you if you're down. That's neat.
Yeah, unless he picks you for a goring. You know, when a bull gets broken off, which is what happens, they call that a sueto. He's alone, he's by himself. That's when they're really dangerous, because they're just like, okay, I'm going to attack everything. When they're in the herd, and the steer is running with them to pull them along. When they're in the herd, they're usually, I mean, they might try to get you if you're too close or something, especially early in the run, but for the most part, they're okay. But when they're alone, those are the gorings you see, where they just start concentrating on somebody and just attacking and attacking. But some of the people that really know about bulls, they'll try to get it on its tail and pull it away and distract it and get it off you. And a bull has a hard time getting his horns all the way to the ground. So if you stay on the ground, he's probably not going to be able to puncture you all the way through. He might be able to injure you, but he's probably not going to be able to kill you. So you're probably still going to live. Most of those guys, you see Gore live. It's the guy who stood up or is standing up and gets it. A couple years ago, another American was killed. He got down, he was on his knees and stood up on his knees, and the bull put his horn down through his shoulder, right through his chest, and killed him. If he just stayed flat, he'd be fine.
Yeah. No shit, man. That's got to suck, getting a horn through your heart. For sure. How did you feel though when you completed the race? Was it just like a euphoric kind of thing?
Yeah, the first time you go through it, especially if you had a good run, yeah, there's this euphoria that lifts you up. The only people that fall in on themselves, and I've seen this a few times, are people that they didn't behave in the street very well. You know, they kind of lost their manliness out there. They panicked and screamed, like, you know, whatever they did. And you can see later, they're just very quiet. They feel very insecure about what happened. I mean, this is kind of the Hemingway's Francis Malcomber kind of thing. You know, the famous short story where the guy runs from the charging lion and then doesn't have manliness until he proves himself again. You see that in people. They're trying to then, unless they then get back into the street and prove themselves next time or find some other way to prove themselves, I think they always have kind of a hole shot right through them, a secret little hole that they're just not comfortable with because they've been tested and they failed, which is fun. We're all going to fail some of these tests, but the thing is, you got to stand up and try again, or at least try something else that proves yourself to yourself.
Mm-hmm. What do you think it is about men that, like, we're always trying to prove ourselves, like trying to prove our manliness? What is it about us that makes us want to do that? And do you think that's like a healthy thing?
It's a very healthy thing, especially when channeled in the right direction. There's real rites of passage. You know, our society is destroying those things, but it's very healthy. I have a 4-year-old, and I'm watching him go through this at 4 years old. He's always anything new comes in the room. He wants to go and test it. You know, and if I discipline him in some way, I'll actually see his chest puff up and his arms come out. Well, he'll try to prove himself back to me. I mean, it's just in there. He's wired that way. It's in his blood, the adrenaline. It's there. So you have to channel that and give these people, especially our youth, a way to prove themselves to themselves in a way that hopefully they're not going to get really hurt at. I mean, I don't know about you, but when I was a teen, I was looking for things all over the place. I did things that, I mean, I was free climbing things that I should not have been anywhere near without ropes. You know, I did some really stupid things because I wanted to test myself and prove myself. And kids will do that, especially if you don't give them some means to go out there and physically, not just on a video game or some other mental way, but to physically and mentally together go out and challenge themselves and prove themselves. You don't give them those avenues, they're going to find them and they might really hurt themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree, man. I can remember doing stupid things too back, you know, 15, 16, 17 years old, jumping off bridges. I'm sure you did some stuff like that, into the water. You know, just dumb things like that all the time. Racing cars, you know, just – I can think of, like, so many things off the top of my head. A lot of which I kind of wish when I have children don't do those things. But you kind of know they're going to want it. Like you said, your kid's 4 years old, son's 4 years old, he's already doing stuff. But I think you're right. If you can channel it in the right direction, maybe because this is kind of when I kind of stopped doing sports and stuff, too. I'm looking back now. It's kind of like the off seasons of sports, or maybe, like, I wasn't doing a sport that year. I think sports are a great way to kind of get that out of you, too. Maybe, like consistently doing, like, boxing. I also did some wrestling, too, later on. But getting into, like, a good sport, maybe a physical sport like one of those, I think is a good way to kind of channel this inner desire to prove ourselves. What do you think about that?
No, sports are made to do that. The issue now with sports isn't that sports aren't good and healthy. It's that too often the parents go after the coaches who try to be that tough role model, who discipline for bad behavior. Someone shows up late to a practice or doesn't do what they're supposed to be doing, and they discipline them. And the parent comes in and says, "How dare you do that to my child?" and goes after the coach. I've seen that again and again in local friends who are coaches, who tell me this. It's the parents. The kids will listen to you, and they want to build themselves up to this thing. They want to be that, depending on what the sport is, that ideal. But too often the parents in the culture we're in today – you know, I'm in the Northeast, and it's especially bad here. They come in and they don't understand what it is that their kids are trying to test themselves and become a part of. And instead of helping them do it, they go after that coach to try to help their kid in some other way. But we all know kids who went through grade school, boys, and never had a fight. Now that seems great and everything. They never had a fight. They're, you know, they're a peacemaker and all this. But when you talk to those guys, especially as they get older, and they went through those critical ages and they didn't have that fight when they're 12 or 14 or whatever. You know, there's something missing in them that they just haven't proven that thing in themselves. I'm not saying fighting is good and you should be a bully. No, anything, you should be anything but. But there is a time when you got to stand up. And if you didn't at a certain age, it gets difficult for people. And they got to find some other way then to prove that within themselves.
Yeah. Man, you just brought up a great point. And I'm over here like smiling because I'm thinking, So I have this kid, and he's probably 18 years old, and he is, like, what you just explained, what you just said, is exactly what came to my mind, like the prototypical person, kid, man, boy, who needed to get into a fight when he was younger. So he's like this really cocky, obnoxious to the point, like he has to be the center of attention. He's always vying for people's attention. He has to, like we went to this party and he was there, and you know, he's just interrupting people and just like being cocky and jumping into different conversations. Like when he wasn't in the conversation, he's like really like femininely dressed. Like I understand the whole, you know, dressing nice and having style. He dresses like flamboyantly, metrosexual. And I have no problem again with style. We talk about style all the time on here, men's style, fashion. You know, I love that stuff. Actually, I'm starting to get into it more and more, but this guy is over the top with it. And again, he has like that obnoxious, cocky personality. I'm like, that kid, you know, he has like a lot of charisma too. He has a lot of good qualities. He was kind of funny from time to time, but he was just over the top with it. Just like in your face with like trying to be, you know, the center of attention. I was like, that kid needed to have his ass kicked when he was younger. He just needed to have a beating when he was younger, just so he could be humbled a little more. Like he's always had, and it kind of goes back to, again, to like that millennial thing that everyone's talking about nowadays. And I agree with it. I'm in the millennial category myself. I'm 26 years old. But I don't consider a lot of millennials. I don't consider myself to be like a lot of millennials. I feel like they're overprivileged. They have everything handed to them. They're kind of like this kid in a lot of ways. Like they always have to kind of get their, you know, people's attention and stuff. And I just literally said this, the exact same thing. It was kind of funny. Like he needed to get his ass kicked, or he needs to get his ass kicked right now by somebody. Just, you know, not put the kid in the hospital, but just a beating, just a beating of some sort. So he did a couple punches in the face, just so he. And I like the kid actually too. I'm not saying this like maliciously, like I want to do it, because I don't. But he needs a couple punches in the face, maybe even, you know, a couple rounds in the boxing ring, just to give him some humbleness and to show him, you know, that there's more to life than what he sees now. And I think what he sees now is that everything has to be, you know, handed to him. He has, you know, all these rights and privileges, and he has this and that, and it's just, you know, he's one of those kids that needs a beating as much as I do like him.
But, and that's what it's all about. I mean, that's what the Marine Corps does, or the Boy Scouts do, or a great karate dojo does. It breaks you down and builds you up and takes a guy like that and teaches him some lessons, some important life lessons. But if you said that to a lot of people in this culture today, boy, the claws will come out. They'll tear you apart. How dare you say that about my son? You can't do that to him. He's a good, you know, wonderful, blah, blah, blah. They would go after you without understanding what it is they're destroying in the process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree, man. And everything's just like, you know, getting, it's too like PC'd, like everything's getting away from, you know, you have to talk to a child this way. You have to, you know, you can't even like, you know, hitting a child, as much as it's not right to abuse a child. I do think personally that, you know, parents should have that right to, if a child gets out of line, to, you know, smack them back in line. And I remember a couple times growing up myself, I had to be, you know, smacked back into line and, you know, tossed around a couple times or whatever. It was nothing. And I know people even my age, people a little older than me, maybe 5-10 years older than me, that's what they kind of knew growing up. And my father was a little different. He's kind of, in a lot of ways, like you, like an outdoorsman kind of guy. He's always just like doing something, fixing cars, doing something outside, chopping wood. Like he's kind of like that. And I think he's more of an old school guy from South Boston. So he kind of was tougher, and he instilled that toughness in me. And I think that's kind of what a lot of men my age or even younger are missing, is like that toughness, that kind of grit that you have to have as a guy. And I think when you miss that, you kind of lean towards like where this kid is going. And again, I like this kid. I think he had a great overall personality. Like he had a lot of good characteristics about him, but I think he just kind of has been PC'd in a way that it's making him a bad person at this point.
I was talking to a couple of kids recently from Vassar College. And then the metrosexual types were very well-educated, polite, thoughtful kind of people, but metrosexual. And I was talking to them, and I wanted to ask them questions more than anything, being a journalist. You know, have you challenged yourself? You know, do you feel like, you know, do you think being a man is a bad thing, or do you think it's a good thing? And for the most part, they had negative ideas about what being a man was, and they're not that. And there's some kind of new age thing that they couldn't really define. And finally, one of them turned to me and says, well, what should I do? What do you think I should do? And I said, how about beginning by rebelling against your parents? And he just didn't know what I was talking about. I said, yeah, a lot of this is from your parents. They haven't challenged you. They haven't disciplined. They haven't given you these means to grow to who you want to be. And now, okay, they're your best friends and all that, but where's the respect? You know, where's – you call them by their first names instead of, you know, the way a lot of them do with their teachers now, their professors, even their college professors. They call them by their first names. You lose that hierarchy, that thing to look up to and grow yourself up to. So I said, what are you going to challenge yourself to? What physically are you going to go out there and do to grow yourself? How are you going to do this? When you enter the workplace, you know, it's not going to be like it is here in academia. You're going to be dealing with the world. And how are you going to do that and develop that character? And there were questions that they really didn't know how to answer. And it's hard to give somebody a direction. We're all individuals. I can give them how I did it or something. I give them other examples. But to give an individual a direction is very hard. But it was just interesting to hear how just really lost they were, but yet how they thought manliness itself was a bad word.
Are you looking to improve your life in a number of very important ways? Do you want to improve, say, your health, your fitness, your business, your dating life, your confidence level, your social skills, even your style? Any one of these areas? If so, the best way to do it right now is to join our Facebook group. The Elite Man Mastermind Group is the best way to build a sense of community online. It's so tough nowadays to feel like you're connected to like-minded people. Joining this Facebook group solves that problem. We have hundreds of awesome people, speakers, thought leaders, life coaches, dating coaches, business leaders, health and fitness experts, bloggers, podcasters, and just regular awesome people like yourself in the group right now. And they're sharing their incredible insights, advice, tips, strategies, and techniques to mastering all sorts of really important areas of your life. If you're serious about improving your life, go right now to Facebook and type in Elite Man Mastermind in the search bar. Type it up right now and join the group. I'll approve the request as soon as possible. It's a closed group, which means it's pretty intimate and not everyone can join. But right now, if you log on, I'll have you added within the same day. I want to get as many awesome people like yourself into the group as possible. We have such a great community of leaders, speakers, coaches, influencers, people to help share their insights with you and share great ideas with each other, to build each other up and build incredible relationships with one another and help each other become the best people we can be. So join this group right now if you're looking to connect with other incredible people just like you and become the best version of yourself. Join now. Go on Facebook and type in Elite Man Mastermind. Okay, back to the show now.
For some reason, manliness or being a man in the past few years, like the past maybe decade or so, has been like something that everyone wants to trash. It's like it's almost like a bad thing to say you want to be a real man, to say you want to be, you know, masculine, stand up for yourself. You know, you have like this just last week, this Million Woman March thing talking about, you know, equal rights and all this other stuff and feminism. And like, I'm listening to some of these people on TV and it's just like, what do you, I mean, I understand the whole equality thing. And again, I don't want to get too political with this because I love a lot of these people that are doing this. And I love a lot of these people that are supporting this thing because they're great people and they're some of the best people in the world. But I just, for some of these people going on TV, I'm listening to them like, what are you even like talking about here? Like they're putting down men, they're saying, you know, everything's unequal, you know, men have everything handed to them, it's you know, easy for to be a man, it's not easy to be a woman, you know, basically touting feminism and how bad it is to be a masculine man in this day and age. And it wasn't just that march, it's just, you know, across the board. You listen to TV, listen to the news, for some reason it's like become popular to you know, bash on men and just kind of bring us down.
Yeah, society's actually been doing that for a very long time. And when I talk to feminists, and I consider myself a feminist in that I believe in true equality, and I think most men today would agree with that. You know, not getting into the politics of abortion and all those other things that they use as their litmus test for if you're a feminist or not, but I'm just talking about basic human equality. We're all equals right down to the core. I think most men today would agree with that. I'm not saying they're not chauvinists out there. No doubt there still are. But today, yeah, if you say man, then as you say men, what some people, unfortunately, from that you're talking about the Million Mile March, read into it is that means you're a misogynist, you're a chauvinist, or you need to put down women to build yourself up. And I look at that, I say, if a man needs to put down women in order to prop up his own ego, then he's too weak to be a real man anyway. He's too insecure. And a real man isn't that insecure. Even if you look back at old codes of honor, I mean, you look back to the old Japanese code of Bushido, it says to treat everyone and think of everyone as equal. It doesn't say that we're being samurai or above you or above. It does not. The old Knights Codes didn't. You know, the Marine Corps Creed doesn't. None of these real good codes do. These bases for what a gentleman is supposed to be, they all think of everyone as being equal, true equality. If that's what that movement is about, then you can achieve it. But they don't really know what they want, which is what's really interesting when you look at feminists. The problem isn't men. They think it's still men. The problem is not men anymore. Maybe it was. I mean, they only won the vote in 1920, which isn't that long ago. You know, so it had been for a very long time, but not anymore. The problem is actually the feminist conception of what a feminist is and what a woman should be. I've been running with the bulls with women. I've hunted dangerous game with women. You know, I've climbed cliffs with women. I've gone into spelunked into caves with women. You know, I went to a military academy. I graduated from a college. It was a military academy with women as fellow cadets. And I knew all these strong women, and I still know a lot of strong women in my life. But they are not what the feminists would call feminists, because they don't agree with those certain kinds of politics. So until the feminists can look at this, that strong woman, that upstanding person who does all the things that feminists are supposed to do, based on true equality, and sees that as the ideal it should be without the politics defining it, until they can understand that and agree with that, they're not going to heal. They're going to continue to attack men as the problem, when the problem isn't that. The problem is their own ideal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they're just kind of looking for things to gripe on and to bash, you know, men on. And it's just like, it's changed since 1920, man. It's changed so much. The culture in America has changed. And I think they're kind of just grasping at straws at this point, trying to find something, and there's really nothing there. And it's just like, you have like this million woman march. I just don't get it, man. It's beyond me. To see like how much, you know, women have, how equal things really are. And I mean, you go to anything, like there's always going to be, you know, a proclivity for men to be better at women in something. You know, take sports, for example. You take officers, like you mentioned, you know, being alongside some very brave, strong women. And I 100% agree with that. But just like going out, you're kind of looking at the genetics of things, looking at how we are. Men are always going to be more inclined to be better than women overall at something. Now, I get you have to have women officers. You have to have women, you know, sports. Totally understand all that stuff. And I think it's great because, you know, it gives them an outlet as well as, you know, men need an outlet. Women do too. But then you look at things like, say, waitressing, bartending, teaching. These are all, for the most part, women jobs. And they're always going to be nursing, and taking care of children. These are always going to be jobs that women are innately better at than men. And of course you have, you know, your men who are great at those things too, and men can go in and fill those jobs as well. But I think women are kind of like, you know, I was talking to someone a few weeks ago about this, and they're like, oh, why are there so many male officers, and, you know, there's only a certain small percentage of women officers? And, you know, as much as it may not be politically correct to say, The reason for that is if you had it 50-50 and it was 50% women, 50% men, police officers say, do you really think that things would be safer that way? If it had to be, you know, right down the line, it had to be 50-50, would it be safer to have, you know, 50% women, 50% men? Probably not. Probably, you know,
aren't going to fix anything. But okay. I wouldn't even go down this philosophical road you're going down. I would just say make it equal, and if a woman can pass the same test and go, you know, because there are always going to be exceptions. You know, a woman recently became an Army Ranger, which is pretty hard to do. A lot failed trying to get there. If they can pass those tests on a truly equal basis, you're not weakening the standards just in order to get women in, but on the best standards possible that we really need for these different categories, then again, God bless them, as long as they can stay in and do that. I mean, a good friend of mine is a retired Green Beret, and I asked him about this. And he said, well, okay, fine. If they can pass all the tests and go through this, but still a Green Beret team needs to pick the best team possible to go into the field for any typical mission. And actually, the sergeants and the captain running a Green Beret team have the ability to pick who they want based on whatever characteristic they would make for that ultimate A team to go in and achieve that mission. And if they think a woman is right for it, great. If they don't, then that's their decision. If these are decisions that happen in the field, to come in with political correctness and say we need certain quotas, so you need a certain number of women on these kind of things, you're right, that deteriorates them. But just, you know, get out of the way and let equality, let them pass the test if they can, and let us pass the test if we can to go into these different job categories, and if let it all shake out on its own.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I mean, man. Like having these quotas, having these things saying you have to have a certain percentage of this, certain percentage of that, I think it takes away the overall quality of what's happening. And it also, you know, consequently can make people a lot less safe. Like if you have 50% women, 50% men, or even firefighters 50%, like whatever it is, if you really wanted to have it right down the line and be 50-50, I think things wouldn't be as safe as they are. And again, it's not because women aren't great. And actually, in a lot of cases, from my experience, women are a lot more mentally strong than men are in a lot of cases. But physically, I'm talking physically here. If you have like a physical job, or if you have a job that maybe innately men are better at, why would you then say women have to, you know, everything has to be fair. Women have to have that job. You know, you have a guy and a girl, and they both had the same score on the test. We're hiring the woman because we have to meet that quota. I just think it's stupid. I think it's silly. And I think a lot of these women, like, that's kind of the mindset a lot of them have is, you know, we have to have everything's fair nowadays. But if you look at things, if you look at just like basic genes and genetics and kind of what we're wired with, what we have inside of us, the tools we have inside of us, men are a lot better in some things than women are. And on the other hand, women are a lot better than men are. It's like you have a, you know, taking care of a child, and then you said, you know, I want to make a certain quota, and all of a sudden you're having all these guys who know nothing about childcare taking care of their children. Things are going to go haywire. You're going to have kids, you know, running out of the house and or lighting the house on fire, and, you know, just they wouldn't be able to do it. So there's certain things that women are better at and certain things that men are better at. And I think trying to kind of have your political correctness and stick it in there can mess a lot of things up.
Yeah, keep our noses out of it. Let the system decide on a truly equal basis. And all these questions, which are impossible to answer. I mean, I see you. I'm raising a 4-year-old with my wife, and I see the differences in our and how we go about doing it, and how we're beneficial on both sides to him. Why it is important to have a man and a woman in the household. I'm seeing it firsthand, first time now, and it's incredible. But to try to articulate that to you, it's not easy to do. I don't know how I would even do it. It would sound sexist right from the start because it's so based on, you know, and just contextual evidence. It's just no real way to define it. So I say just stay out of the way and let true equality and freedom just be the decision maker.
Yeah, I agree, man. It's gonna balance itself out anyways. I just hate to see it go the other way because we're living in such a politically correct society where they kind of impose this quota or impose these laws where things have to be one way. And it does irk me a certain way when I hear things like that. And, you know, especially these feminists on TV going crazy about how awful men are. It's like,
yeah, I'm sick of hearing that. You're right. Right. You know, in a similar kind of topic, after my book, The Ultimate Man's Survival Guide, came out, I had a journalist from Germany with their publication, Der Spiegel. He wanted to talk. He wanted to interview me. So I said, great. Okay. So we got on the phone together and we're talking. And the whole conversation, all he wanted to do was paint me into a corner of being homophobic, being anti-homosexual. He kept asking me, can a man be a real man if he's this sexual orientation or that sexual orientation? And I kept just coming back to character and saying, if he's honest and stand up and he can do these kind of things, then why isn't he a real man? I don't understand why you're bringing sex into this kind of thing. You know, where is that? And I look at even the same with women, because if you're going to really truly decide, define what makes manliness, how do you define manliness? You can't define it by muscle, because, I mean, a really strong guy might panic at the sight of blood and run away screaming, while a really skinny guy goes and applies a tourniquet and saves a guy's life, right? He's the hero. He manned up and he did it. It didn't have anything to do with his muscles. You know, they can maybe show signs of whether you're manly or not, but you don't know until someone acts. So it's character. You always have to weigh these things on the basis of character. It's the only way you can really define manliness is character. So I don't even bring gender into the conversation, really, which makes me sound really PC, but when you really get down to it, that's the only way you can really define what makes a man. It's character. It's not sexual orientation. I wouldn't even think it's gender. It's character. And to a certain degree, and I agree with where you're going with the conversation for the most part, that a man of a certain character and a certain, you know, just by and large in general, is going to be more adept to certain jobs than a woman is, and vice versa. But I say stand back. I don't know. Any individual can do any one thing. So let's just define them by character and let them all go on an equal basis. And let the chips fall where they will. That's what's great about this free society.
Mm-hmm. No, I absolutely agree, man. All about free society, all about that. 100%. Like, couldn't agree with you anymore. The only thing I would say is letting the free society dictate itself and not imposing laws or quotas or things like that. I hate those things.
That's key.
That's it. But, yeah, totally.
Which is what they're trying to do with political correctness and feminism and so on. They're trying to destroy – and they are, to a large extent, destroying manliness. I mean, I look back all the way to 1955 when Rebel Without a Cause was made, you know, the classic Red Dean film, right?
Yeah.
Where he's trying to man up to the whole movie, and he keeps asking his father, you know, what does it take to be a man? You know, what should I do to be a man? His father never has an answer for him through that whole movie, Rebel Without a Cause. And the movie ends that way. He's always slouching James Dean. He's never really strong. He doesn't know what to do. He never proves himself. And okay, it's a beautiful movie, and it says something really powerful. about a guy trying to prove himself, and no one's giving him the means to do it. No one's showing him which way to go. What icon does he chase? How does he become this guy? No one shows him. That's where society was starting to get to, with feminism then really becoming big. But in the years since then, what answers have they given us, the feminists, you know, that part of mainstream society? What have they given men since then? They've been tearing it down ever since then. That's more than a half century ago, which is – so it's no surprise that here we are, two guys talking about this and trying to figure it out. And I spent a lot of my journalistic life trying to answer these questions, because they've been buried. They've been taken from us. They've been ripped out of society for so long that you really have to hunt for them now. They're just not evident.
Yeah. No, I agree, man. It's still a constant search. And I get this question a lot, too, you know, what it means to be an elite man, because that's my brand, Elite Man Magazine, Elite Man Podcast. And I say, I mean, it's a couple of, you know, little – subcategories and stuff, but the main thing I always say is that being an elite man just literally means being the best version of yourself every day, or trying to be the best version of yourself every day, whether that's business, health, life, dating, confident, whatever it is that you're trying to conquer in your life, master in your life, putting your best foot forward every day and taking the right steps to being the best version of yourself. And then we talk about things like having values, characters, sticking up for people, sticking up for what's right, things like that. But it really just comes down to being the best version of yourself. And that's what I believe an elite man is. And I think what being a man is in 2017, this day and age.
I love that definition. In fact, Ray Bradbury, the writer, he said, find your hero and chase him, and then you'll become who you want to be. Mm-hmm. You know, it's another way of saying that same thing. Be your best self. That's perfect.
Cool, man. I appreciate it. So you mentioned, I think it was in the This Will Make You a Man book. Is that right? You say Ernest Hemingway. You talk about Ernest Hemingway, Babe Ruth, Ben Franklin, John Wayne, Teddy Roosevelt. What are the things that these, like, what's the one thing that connects these historical men together? And what's that kind of trait that they have in common that you like to talk about?
Yeah, they were all men following a code. And you know, Hemingway's famous for being a man of with a code. And how do you define a code? And what is your code? What are you living by? I mean, and This Will Make a Man of You, I put a lot of codes of honor, from the Japanese Code of Bushido to Ben Franklin's Rules of Improvement to the Ten Commandments to the Taoism's code and so on. Because what I think a guy should do, the Marine Corps Creed and all this, I think a guy should look at these codes, and none of them are going to be completely relevant to his life unless he happens to be a Marine or something. Look at all these codes and say, what rules should I live by? And look at them and say, I like that, I like that, and write your own code, which is what I've done. And then once you understand what your code is, what you're standing, you have to continue to improve it throughout life, or, you know, to some extent, to refine that code. But once you start living on that, those ideals, it makes it much easier to stand up and be that guy you want to be, because those codes are simply put, like your elite man's one is, and be your best self. You can see it that simply. So you find yourself in the throes of these big, complex gray areas in life when you're not really sure what to do. But your code is simple. There it is. It's a 10-point plan, or however many points it is. You know what to do immediately. So you do the right thing on impulse, as habit. I mean, that's what Aristotle said. You build good habits. You build bad ones, you can build good ones. Build good habits. That becomes your code. It's how you live. And that's what I found. I mean, I chased Ernest Hemingway for This Will Make a Man of You from those cafes in Paris where that sophisticated guy would hang out, right? One side of the self, right? That urban sophisticate that he represented, friends with Pablo Picasso and F. Scott Fitzgerald. Yet then he went to Pamplona, and he did that in Sun Also Rises, and he did that in real life, to run with bulls, to get in that street, to get in the arena with those vaquillas, those cows with leather on the horns that are just, they're in there to throw you around. He went through that whole process, both sides of the self, right? The sophisticate and the guy who can get in the boxing ring, who could get in a safari tent, Hemingway would. Those two sides of the self, where we've kind of split today. There's the urban sophisticate, the metrosexual today, and then you have the rural redneck, right? Those are the two cliches. Well, it used to be the well-rounded guy was supposed to be both. And those two things embolden each other, because you really can't understand art and understand yourself and your relationship to art unless you physically have tested yourself. You know, we're not just mental beings. We're physical beings. We're both. So you got to have the manly, tough side that's gone out and proven himself, the redneck side that I like to go out and do the outdoor survival kind of stuff. And you've got to have the sophisticated side, the guy who's really asking these questions, the guy who's reading and thinking and watching podcasts like yours and trying to learn and improve himself, be his best self all the time. And then those two things come together and you become that old-fashioned ideal, a well-rounded man.
Love it, man. That's awesome too, as well. And obviously those guys are all historical legends, like, you know, whether that's writing, playing baseball, inventor, politician, famous actor, really cool, great guys. And a lot of these guys I've looked up to, you know, read about them, read their books, their stories about them for years. So I like how you kind of tie that all together. It's really interesting for sure. Switching gears a bit, man, I want to talk about some of the survival sort of techniques. I know we're kind of running on time here, probably sort of wrap things up in a bit. But what are – so I want to run through some of these techniques. The first one that pops up was something that you mentioned in the book, The Ultimate Man Survival Guide. How would you survive a fight, a tussle with a bear if you came in contact with one?
I've been charged by a lot of bears, black bears and grizzlies. In fact, I once went with a researcher in Montana whose job it is to condition bears that are getting too close to people, grizzlies. So he goes in with his Karelian bear dog and his bear spray and his 44 pistol on his side. And he goes right after the bears. And I was with him, too, and we got charged together. And I've been charged in the Yukon. I've been charged in Alaska. I've been charged in Wyoming. For the most part, you have to – if it's a grizzly charging, it depends. You have to understand what the bear is, what you're dealing with. If it's a sow and cubs – you don't want to, and a grizzly sow with cubs, you don't want to fight the bear. So you take some knowledge of the animals themselves to survive these things. You don't want to fight the bear because she's just trying to deal with the threat and then she wants to get away, right? You know, so pretty much if you can get away or use bear spray, great, but otherwise don't fight that bear. But if it's a lone bear, grizzly or black bear, fight that bear. He's going to try to kill you, especially if it's a black bear, he's going to try to kill and eat you. You know, I've had to face down several. One was pretty close, pretty violent. You have to face down that bear or he'll come and he'll get you. You have to stop that attack. But if you're actually physically in the attack, loud noises are key. You can bang two pots together. I mean, whatever. I've used bear spray on bears before. It does work. You can stop that. Especially works on grizzlies. It doesn't work as well on black bears, but you can use it. I mean, there are all these techniques. People say hit him in the nose. I don't know how possibly you'd be able to do that. You know, but you do have to fight back. If that's a lone bear and he's after you, then he's going to kill and he might even try to eat you, which happened in New Jersey last year, of all places. I mean, this happens more than we think. So you do have to fight back. Don't back down, especially to a black bear. Never back down. He's going to circle you. He's going to think about it. He's trying to weigh whether you're weak enough to deal with. I mean, there's all these levels to it that you have to learn. But you're really reading the behavior of that animal and how do you deal with that animal back and forth. And I have a lot of experience in it, so I can go on about it. But you know, that's where you have to get. It takes some real knowledge of the animal itself in order to survive that safely.
Oh, that's incredible, man. I'm just thinking a couple months ago, I was running through the woods up the street from my house, and this giant deer just hopped. I was on this path, and this deer is probably like 6 feet tall or some massive deer, jumped out in front of me. It scared the shit out of me. I can't imagine being charged at from a grizzly or a black bear. How was that? How nerve-wracking was that for you when that actually happened?
You know, I don't know why it is, but I go cold in those situations. I don't really freak. It's later that you start shaking, the adrenaline's all in you. Mm-hmm. But at the time, I've always kept my composure. You know, I got charged last year by a black bear. It was a sow with cubs, and I was hunting turkeys in the Catskill Mountains. And she charged in, but I knew she wasn't going to come all the way. So I just stood there. I had the gun leveled in her direction. I could have killed her. I mean, it's a plenty powerful gun, close range, the 12 gauge to take her out. But I knew I didn't have to. She was going to stop. It was a false charge. She stopped about 10 feet from me. She hopped up and down on her feet and she barked at me, which they'll do, sat their jaws together. And I just calmly talked to her and I just, okay, when she started to turn away, I just walked away and I kept her eye contact and kept talking to her. So, you know, you just have to keep that. A couple of years ago, I got charged by a group of elephants. Wow. And that was interesting. I know about elephants, but it was my first charge. We were actually, I was with a game ranger in Kruger National Park. He's one of those guys that hunts rhino poachers. And we're standing there and these elephants are feeding up toward us. And he said, don't worry, they're fine. They know we're here. They're approaching us. It's not going to be an issue. But they got pretty close. And then suddenly one of the bulls just stopped, totally still, got really stiff. He looked at us from the corner of his eye and then he charged. And he ran right into this tree, knocked the tree over. It was so close that the leaves actually blew past me from the tree he knocked over. Oh. And the elephant stopped, put his ears way out, and looked down at us. And I was looking up into his eyes, you know. But I knew, based on my wildlife knowledge, that this elephant wasn't going to come and kill us because he kept his ears out. If they pin their ears back, they're coming to kill you. But if they keep their ears out, they're trying to make themselves look really big as they possibly can, and it's a bluff. They want to show you, look how tough I am. And also I knew not to run because the game ranger next to me just kept his, and I was going to do what he did. If he ran, I'd been running. But he stayed next to me. We both stood there. We stood down this charging bull. And then the game ranger took off his hat and shook it at the elephant and just screamed, "Get out of here." And I screamed at him, "Get the hell out of here." And then the elephant, he flinched like a dog you're trying to kick. I mean, the thing is, I don't know how many tons. The elephant flinches and the elephant just runs away.
Wow.
You know, it teaches you something. And it's understanding what you're involved with, what the animal might do based on its characteristics, like bulls in the street in Pamplona, understanding what they're likely to do. You can kind of read the body language and see what's happening. And then that's how you get safe in those pretty volatile moments.
Yeah, that's a hell of a story, man, for sure. Definitely something, you know, definitely something you can look back and kind of laugh at now. But I mean, I'm sure it's scary as hell in the moment. But you're right. I think knowing how to handle each situation, they're all going to be a little different. Knowing to handle each situation, kind of being able to read the animal is probably operative. Best kind of practice there. Did you ever have to physically get into like an encounter with a bear or you know, any other type of animal like that? Like without a gun?
No, I've never had to fight one or shoot one physically.
Okay.
I killed a brown bear. I've got a big brown bear rug in my office floor. But it was very close, about 15 feet where I killed him. But and he would have turned nasty if I didn't make a lethal shot right away on him. I knew how to do it ethically and, you know, and cleanly. Luckily I haven't yet. I've had many close calls. In Texas a couple years ago, I looked down and I was turkey hunting and it was a rattlesnake on my foot. Wow. But it was just kind of passing through. It was a very big snake. He crawled over my foot. It just kept passing through. I did come to think of it, have to run away from a rattlesnake once. I was fly fishing in Wyoming and one started swimming past me. And I just swatted it with my fly rod thinking I'll get rid of you. But rattlesnakes have tempers. And I was standing in the middle of the water. And when I swatted him, he got mad. He came right at me across that water. And I tell you, I got out of that water as fast as I possibly could. So there is a time to run, I'll tell you that.
Oh, man. That's awesome, man, for sure. I appreciate you sharing these stories, too. They're really good. What is a couple of other like survival tips, I guess. What are your best hunting tips? Like if someone's like interested in hunting, I actually haven't been able to hunt yet, though it's something I want to do soon. What are your like best tips for I guess game hunting, going out there, going in the wilderness and actually being able to potentially, I mean, if it ever came down to like a survival situation, I actually had a doomsday prepper guy on my show a couple months back, Jim Cobb, really interesting guy. But I always kind of have that in the back of my mind too, like having that skill to being able to hunt, get animals if it came down to it, being able to live off an animal. What are some of your best tips for being able to hunt and actually get, you know, game or prey?
Okay, I'm a big bow hunter. I mean, I do a lot of this stuff. But what I do if somebody wants to start or if they're curious about it is I don't talk to them about killing. And that's a whole – learning how to kill is a whole other process. First, you have to learn about your relationship to real nature, because modern environmentalists have it that we're separate from nature and that when we walk into nature, we contaminate nature just by our very presence. Well, that's not true. I mean, you look back at history and we were always hunter-gatherers. We were a part of nature. We're still a part of nature now. We build our homes, and they come into our yards, and they do it in my yard. Deer eat my shrubs. You know, they'll come in. We're a part of it. This is where they're feeding, and then they go bed somewhere else. We're all integrated together in these ecosystems and understanding that. So when I walk a person into the forest, I show them the browse line, because deer are literally creating a browse line in the forest. And a lot of urban areas are actually starving to death. They're low nutrition because they're browsing away the understory of the forest, to the extent where they don't have anything left to eat under there, so they have to come into suburbia to find food or into farms to find food, right? So they're actually destroying their own habitat. And by doing that, they're actually affecting the whole ecosystem because there's a lot of ground nesting birds that disappear. There's a lot of small game, rough grouse, rabbits, these kind of things that disappear because they no longer have vegetation for protection from predators, right, from coyotes or hawks and so on. So you end up with this whole parts of our ecosystem that disappear because we're not managing the deer properly. We are a part of the system. We have to be a part of the system. If we don't stay engaged in the system, then we start to actually harm it by not understanding it. So when I walk a person in the forest, I show them all these things, and I show them where deer sleep, where they walk, what they eat, and why, and how the whole thing works. Then they realize it's symbiotic. We're all a part of it. And that's real environmentalism. You know, hunter is a real environmentalist when he does things properly. They realize, wow, I'm a part of this system. You pick up the hunting magazines, you go through them, you'll find half the stories around biology, what they're eating and why. Because hunters need to know this stuff in order to be effective hunters. They have to be ecologists and all this other stuff. So when they really start to understand that whole process and that they're a part of it, that's beautiful. And that's deep. And that sucks them in. That intrigue, that makes them curious. That makes them, just opens them up, their curiosity. And instead of, and some hunters will just talk to them about, well, you shoot this thing and I put the head on the wall. That's not something someone can relate to. That's bloody. That's final. That's the, you know, that's the end. You call it the climax. I think it's anticlimactic because when the thing is dead, it's done. I mean, it's lost its dignity. It only has the dignity you still give it, that fallen game animal. So you have to understand your whole deep part of that real process. You show that to somebody and you watch them open up. It's beautiful.
Yeah, no, for sure, man. I appreciate your take on that too. Like you said, it's not about like killing animals. It's not about going out there and putting things on your wall just because you can, or just because you have a good gun or something that allows you to in this day and age. It's more about the connection to nature, the connection or the realization of being, you know, knowing that you're part of the ecosystem, knowing that you're part of the way things ebb and flow and kind of the world. And I think it does give you a new perspective. I have a bunch of hunting buddies, and this is why I want to kind of do it soon. They've been telling me they go up to they got a house in Vermont. They go up there every winter and every year. I mean, I'm kicking myself in the ass. I didn't go up this year, but every year they're telling me to come up with them. And there's something to it that they just love the feeling of being up there, being in the outdoors, standing up on that tree thing for hours on end, like a whole day. I mean, it's not like it's something like it's all action and like, you know, and crazy adrenaline rush. It's just more like you're being part of something out in the wilderness and just connecting with nature. And then like having that rush when you do see, you know, an animal go by, you do finally see the deer go by. I know the way they explain it to me, I can just see the excitement in their eyes when they're talking about it. And and you know, talking to you right now kind of makes me want to do it even more because of
love what they hunt. You know, they won't use the word love. The guy's not going to talk that way. You know? I will, but they're not going to. But they do. You really talk to them about it, and they're passionate about it. They see deer, even if they're not going to shoot those deer. They're after something else. They love seeing it. They love being a part of it. They love watching. They put up their game trail cameras and stuff and get the photos and see where they are and what's going on. And they're into the whole thing. They actually love what they hunt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure, man. So the other one I wanted to ask for survival tips, go to the last one. I mean, I have a bunch on here. We could go through this all day, but I know we got to kind of wrap things up. What are your tips on surviving or starting a fire? Like if you had to survive out in the wilderness, what are your ways to like start a fire and actually get heat?
Yeah, I've started fires without matches. I've gone through that whole process, and it's an art more than a skill, you know. But what I tell people, if you're going to go into the wilderness, I mean, make sure you have a little survival kit with you. I mean, carry some means to start fires. Carry a lighter, carry a candle, and carry some kind of material, some kind of dry material or flammable material. You know, cotton with wax on it actually works great. It'll burn for a long time. Something you can light then, you know, or just carry some kind of fire starter material. It could be what you use actually to start your campfire. You know, some of the Sterna or whatever. Carry a little bit of that. And then you'll be able to find the dry tinder and to make your fire when you need to. You never want to have to rub two sticks together to make a fire. I mean, it's not easy. Watch Naked and Afraid and watch them try to do it. It's funny.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, man. Like I watch these shows, these survivalist shows, and even these survivalist experts have been doing this for years, you know, 20, 30, 40 years they've dedicated their whole life to. You watch them in these shows and they're struggling to make a fire. It's like, are these guys just kind of bullshitting us? Like they really have this experience? But no, they're not. They're not. It actually is that tough to do. Like it can take hours or whatever, like trying to, you know, whittle two sticks together or some of the other techniques they use. It's like really tough to do. So I think, you know, having that fire starter, whether it's matches, fireproof waterproof matches, Bic lighter, something Jim Cobb mentioned, candle, I love that idea as well. Magnesium, I think, is another good starter, like the magnesium kit.
And natural, I mean, fire pitch, you can go to a pine tree and find the pitch, and that will start a fire wonderfully too. I mean, there's not a lot of natural elements that will help you. But if you're in a damp forest, especially a jungle, and you're trying to start a fire without matches, it isn't easy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely, man. So Frank, kind of wrapping things up, man, it's been, you know, a hell of a talk. I just, you know, we went off into a couple different areas, you know, political, kind of feminist, the manly kind of side of things, the passage, the rite of passage, some survival tips. Man, it's been, you know, really interesting and a hell of an interview. Is there, sort of wrapping things up, is there a last sort of send-off message you'd like to leave the Elite Man audience, and then also our place that our listeners can check out more about your work?
Yeah, I think, as we said earlier, find your hero, you know, and chase, and it'll change as you go through life. You know, it should be a changing thing. I mean, Indians would actually change names as they got older because they were proving themselves and their man upon a new ideal. So find your next hero and chase that ideal, an archetype. Because as soon as you start chasing an ideal, you decide, I want to be this or what have you, that will lead you into your next rite of passage. That will test you and grow you and turn you into that next self. Because life is chapters. So continue to find that hero and refine that hero and find those new heroes. I mean, my latest one was running with the bulls and how to become that ultimate bull runner. What is that going to teach me? You know, and I'm looking for another. I mean, what do you do? How do you grow yourself to become those things? If you chase, I mean, this is now a society now that destroys ideals. They don't believe in ideals. They think that's overly simplistic thinking or something, because how can anyone ever be perfect? Well, I'm not talking about a perfect person. I'm talking about an ideal. Find an ideal and chase that ideal. To find out more about me, my books are all on Amazon. This Will Make a Man of You, The Ultimate Man Survival Guide. My other books are all on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever books are sold. I write a weekly column for Forbes. I write a weekly column for America's First Freedom. I'm a contributor to Outdoor Life magazine, to American Hunter, and a lot of other places. So you Google me. I have lots out there. My website is frankminiature.com. So I'm all over the place.
Cool, man. I appreciate that. Guys, definitely check out Frank. He has a ton. He's a wealth of knowledge. I mean, I could literally sit here and talk probably for another 6 hours about some of the stuff he does. He works on survivalist guy, you know, a rite to passage for men. All this incredibly interesting stuff, work he's doing, it's fascinating to me, and I know you guys are going to love it, so definitely check him out, frankminiture.com, some of the other Forbes and some of the other places he's on, and in the book too, which I mentioned in the beginning of the show, The Ultimate Man Survival Guide, one of the coolest books I have ever read in my entire life, and the facts, the tips, you mentioned a couple of them that he mentions in the book about the bears, and fishing tips he's got in there, he's got starting a fire, hunting tips. Really, really cool book, fascinating book. So again, Frank, thanks so much for coming on the show, man. I appreciate it, and take care.
Anytime, Justin. Thank you.
All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I need you to do. I need you to subscribe to this podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast interviews with all of our incredible world-class guests from the lifestyle, health, fitness, business, and social worlds absolutely free. Subscribe now, guys, if you haven't already, and enjoy all future episodes. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an awesome review. We really do appreciate it.